In the famous book and movie To Kill a Mockingbird, attorney Atticus Finch defends an African-American man named Tom Robinson, who is accused of raping a Caucasian woman named Mayella Ewell in Monroeville, Alabama in 1936. Ewell was assaulted by a left-handed person, prompting one of the most memorable courtroom scenes in film history.
Tom, will you catch this, please? Thank you. Now then. This time, will you please catch it with your left hand?
I can't, sir.
Why can't you?
I can't use my left hand at all. I got it caught in a cotton gin when I was 12 years old. All my muscles were tore loose.
In his book Just Mercy, Bryan Stevenson uses Harper Lee's story as the framing device for the case of African-American exoneree Walter McMillan, who was accused of murdering a Caucasian woman he had been having an affair with in Monroeville. Stevenson writes that, quote, "What is often overlooked is that the black man falsely accused in To Kill a Mockingbird was not successfully defended by Atticus. Tom Robinson, the wrongfully accused black defendant, is found guilty." McMillan had the same result, despite six alibi witnesses who testified that he had been a fish fry at the time of the murder. Stevenson writes about the impossibility of McMillan receiving a fair trial from an all-white jury in 1988, given that Alabama was one of 16 states that still had anti-miscegenation laws prohibiting marriage between blacks and whites at the time Loving v. Virginia was decided in 1967, and maintained a state constitutional ban on interracial marriage until 2000. North Carolina was also one of the 16 states with anti-miscegenation laws at the time of Loving v. Virginia. In fact, it was the only state that submitted an amicus brief in support of Virginia's law. And it wasn't until 1977 that North Carolina passed a law recognizing all interracial marriages. Ronnie Long's trial started on September 27, 1976, a mere 5 months after the crime, and the year before North Carolina changed its anti-miscegenation law.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The State vs. Ronnie Long. This is our third in a series of four episodes about the case of Ronnie Long, who was accused of raping Judd E. Bost in Concord, North Carolina on April 25th, 1976. And my name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author. I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at theviewfromll2.com. And I'm going to go ahead and apologize for this week's sound quality for me. I'm currently at Innocence Conference 2018 in Memphis and recording from a slightly very noisy hotel room.
In the first two episodes, we laid out the basics of what will become the case against Ronnie Long. First, Judd E. Bost identified him in an unusual courtroom procedure. Second, a leather jacket, black gloves, and five matchbooks were seized during a possibly non-consensual search when Ronnie went to the police station later that day under false pretenses. And third, Concord Police Department Identification Officer Van Eisenhower lifted a latent shoe print from outside the victim's house and later seized Ronnie's shoes while he was awaiting arraignment in Kannapolis. This was all of the evidence the state had against Ronnie Long as his trial began in a courtroom that was divided along racial lines.
The first issue that had to be resolved at trial was whether Judd E. Bost would even be able to testify that she identified Ronnie Long when he'd appeared in the court on his trespassing charge, and later when she picked him out of the photo array. We laid out the basic issues with these identifications earlier in episode one, but there's one thing that needs to be added.
Who could just walk out on this park committing a CID? Judge say, did you see him in the park? The park committee say, no. Well, how do you know who's in the park? He's sitting in the jury box. Thank you, David Taylor Marcy. They sit in the jury box. And they say, we the one saw him in the park.
So, if you couldn't hear that, the park commissioner told the judge that he didn't see Ronnie Long in the park and directed the judge to the two police officers sitting in the jury box, who told the judge that they were the ones who saw Ronnie Long. These were, of course, the same officers who'd told Juddy Boss that her assailant might be in court that day. And it wouldn't have been too hard for Boss to connect the dots and figure out from this exchange that Ronnie Long was a suspect. But the judge denied the defense counsel's motion to preclude Boss's testimony, concluding that, quote, "The officers in the courtroom identification did not point out to Mrs. Boss the defendant or suggest to her that he was a person who was suspected of being her assailant on that occasion." And so Boss was able to testify about her identifications of Ronnie Long, and Dr. Lance Truman Moore, who treated her on the night of the crime, followed up by testifying about how he was able to conclude that Boss was sexually assaulted.
Now let's lay out all the rest of the state's evidence against Ronnie Long. As we noted in episode 1, Ronnie Long was reasonably tall, muscular and dark-skinned, with a clear accent and facial hair, while Juddy Boss described her assailant as a shortish, slim, light-skinned African-American man with no accent and no mention of facial hair. Or at least, that's the description we have in the documented police interviews that we have from the case file. When Juddy Boss took the witness stand at trial, however, she would claim that the police interviews were incomplete. Here's her testimony about identifying Ronnie Long in the courtroom on May 10th, 1976. Question: on that day, did Mr. Long have any facial hair?
Yes.
What sort of facial hair?
The same he had when he raped me.
That being what, ma'am?
A little tiny mustache and sort of a spotted, unshaven beard.
On cross-examination, defense counsel had Boss read the description of the second statement she gave on the night of the assault to Sergeant Taylor. It contained no mention of facial hair, prompting the following exchange. Question: thank you. The description you just read contained absolutely nothing about a mustache or hair on his face or anything else. Is that correct?
That's right.
And the reason you didn't tell the officers anything about that was because you were afraid you hadn't looked at his face?
Oh no, heavens no. That's just an incomplete description.
Yes, ma'am, that you made?
Well, there was a description before that. That's not the only description I made.
Now, there was indeed a description before that. Boss gave an initial description of her assailant to Sergeant Jack Parnell, who, as you might recall, said he arrived at the crime scene a mere 15 to 20 seconds after receiving the 911 call. After speaking with Boss, Parnell relayed what she told him to another officer who created a report. That report also did not mention facial hair. Sergeant Parnell was cross-examined about that report at trial. Question: and you didn't tell the person who made that report anything about a mustache or a beard, did you?
No, sir.
And that was because Mrs. Boss hadn't said anything to you about a mustache or a beard?
What I testified to is what she stated to me on the bed.
Returning to Sergeant Taylor, the person who took Boss' second statement, he did testify that Boss mentioned her assailant having facial hair that night. Thereafter, he was rigorously cross-examined about this testimony. Question: isn't it a fact that it was only after Mrs. Boss saw these pictures that any discussion of the beard and mustache came into place?
No, sir, that's not a fact. She did not see the photograph until the lineup photograph.
Question: how many officers worked in this case, to your knowledge?
6 detectives.
The report you referred to earlier is still contained in your workbook right in front of you, isn't it?
Yes, sir.
It doesn't show any corrections or additions by any officers to indicate there was any original identification, including the mustache and beard, does it?
That's correct.
And in fact, there are quite a few reports in here from other officers, isn't that correct?
Yes, sir.
Defense counsel then asked Taylor whether any of the reports mentioned the assailant having any facial hair, and he said he didn't remember. So defense counsel had Taylor read each of the reports, and no, it turned out that none of them mentioned the assailant having any facial hair. In closing argument, the prosecutor tried to salvage the state's argument that Boss said her assailant had facial hair on the night of the crime by making the following argument.
And the very next day, they brought in 13 photographs of 13 black males with mustaches and beards and handed them to her and said, "Mrs. Boss, see if you can pick out your assailant."
Except the prosecutor was wrong. Very wrong. We have the 13 photographs shown to Boss after the assault. 6 of the men had no facial hair whatsoever, 4 had a mustache and no beard, 1 had a beard and no mustache, and only 2 had a beard and mustache. For his part, Ronnie Long understandably thinks this part of Boss' description of her assailant was added after the fact.
"And she never mentioned anything about the assailant or the perpetrator having facial hair. Never. They take the photo of me. You understand? And I gotta come in and take the photo of me talking about, well, look, turn to the side. Look, okay, we got facial hair. Now they gonna add that into the description."
When it comes to your health, brushing your teeth is one of the most important parts of your day. Quip knows that. They've combined dentistry and design to make a better electric toothbrush. Quip is the new electric toothbrush that packs just the right amount of vibrations into a slimmer design at a fraction of the cost of bulkier traditional electric brushes. and guiding pulses alert you when to switch sides, making brushing for the right amount of time effortless. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for hygienic travel anywhere, whether it's going in your gym bag or your carry-on luggage. And because the thing that cleans your mouth should also be clean, Quip's subscription plan refreshes your brush on a dentist-recommended schedule, delivering new brush heads every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip is backed by a network of over 10,000 dental professionals, including dentists, hygienists, and dental students. Most toothbrushes don't get named one of Time's best inventions of the year, but Quip did, so find out for yourself why. Now, my problem is I brush too hard and for too long, and that can lead to abrasions and gum recession. But with the pulses in Quip and the refreshing of the toothbrush heads, it's fixed those problems for me. And now it can help you too. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/undisclosed right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/undisclosed. That's spelled GETQUIP.com/undisclosed.
There was also another key aspect of Boss' story that changed to Ronnie Long's detriment at trial. As we noted last episode, black gloves were found in the Long family car when Ronnie went to the police station, and the police report indicated that Boss said her assailant, quote, could possibly have been wearing gloves. At trial, during cross-examination, the defense showed Boss this police report and asked if it was an accurate representation of what she told the police. Her two responses were as follows.
It says, could possibly be wearing gloves. He was wearing gloves.
And then she said,
yes, this is very fair. With the exception, he was definitely wearing gloves.
Now, who knows whether the jury credited this clarification, but if they did, you can see its significance. If the assailant merely might have had gloves, the gloves found in the Long family car don't have much significance. But if the assailant was definitely wearing gloves, those gloves are another piece of corroboration for Boss' story.
Next, we have the toboggan, which Boss said her assailant had been wearing on the night of the assault. Now, the first question I had when I saw this, and judging from listener questions we got, I'm not the only one, was why on earth the assailant was wearing a sled on his head? So, let's clarify this a bit. According to the website letterpile.com, while the word toboggan typically refers to a sled, there is a southern region of the United States that uses Southern American English, and they use the term toboggan as a hat, specifically a ski hat or a ski mask. Although I'm going to question that because being from Georgia, I have never heard someone refer to a hat as a toboggan. So I'm going to go ahead and say it's some kind of weird Carolina thing. Anyway, as we noted in the last episode, Johnny Boss' police statement indicates that she said her assailant had a dark toboggan pulled low on his head. So, hearing this, close your eyes for a second and picture how low you think the toboggan was on the assailant's head. Ronnie's mother took this to mean that the toboggan was quite low.
First she said he had on a mask. Then she said he had on a cap and a black jacket. And I don't know what, and everybody should have seen her. She didn't know what she was talking about. And in the paper, she said he had on a ski mask and a whatever a ski mask is. I don't know what that is. Somebody told me it was a toboggan with holes in it. It covers your face.
And at trial, Boss would testify as follows about the toboggan. He had a toboggan on that was pulled down over his ears. Question: did the toboggan in any way obscure the face of that man? Answer: no. So the question is whether Boss' police statement and testimony line up. Could the assailant have had a toboggan pulled low on his head, but with the toboggan not in any way obscuring his face? It's kind of hard to say, but we do know that the police said they recovered a toboggan from the Long family car, although it wasn't the dark toboggan described by Boss, but instead a lime green toboggan with what looked like red hairs in it.
The next pieces of evidence against Ronnie Long were the five matchbooks recovered from the Long family car. As we noted last episode, Lieutenant Vogler testified that the matchbooks contained the same type of matches as the matches found at the crime scene by the banister that the police believe the assailant used to enter the victim's house. Finally, as we noted in the first episode, Concord Police Department Identification Officer Van Eisenhower said he lifted a shoe print from the flat part of that banister, and as we noted in episode 2, Van Eisenhower got Ronnie Long to give him his shoes while he awaited arraignment. Ink impressions were made of Ronnie's shoes and later marked as State's Exhibits 15A and 15B. The lifted shoe print was later marked as State's Exhibit 13. The evidence was then shown to Dennis Mooney, a shoe print expert with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigations. Mooney testified at trial that he compared the shoe prints using, quote, caliber spiders, oblique lighting, and a visual examination. From this comparison, he was able to testify as follows.
It is my opinion after examination that State's Exhibit number 13 could have been made by State's Exhibits 15A or 15B.
Now, it's important to note that Mooney then specifically said he couldn't testify that the shoe print definitely came from Ronnie Long's shoes, and testified that he was able to make such a positive identification in other cases. And that's it. Van Eisenhower would testify that this was all the physical evidence collected and tested in Ronnie Long's case. Now, at this point, you might be wondering how there could be so little evidence in a rape and burglary case, and you wouldn't be alone.
I'm telling Ronnie Long that he took half of me. Why come they ain't saying nothing about that? Why come they ain't bringing this up? My mom will look at me and tell me, say, don't let, be patient, don't let the jury see you get excited. Don't get excited. Just remain calm. Don't let the jury see you get excited.
But the state would maintain that this was all the evidence they had, and while maybe it wasn't a mountain of circumstantial evidence, it was at least a hill, and it all pointed in the direction of Ronnie Long possibly being the perpetrator.
Our new sponsor Ring first made a splash when they were on Shark Tank a few years ago, because the concept is a genius. If someone rings your doorbell and you aren't home or you don't want to come to the front door, well, you can respond to the person using just your smartphone, adding a level of both security and convenience. And today, over a million people are using the Ring video doorbell to help protect their homes, and those million people include me. Now, I live in a fairly safe neighborhood. I'm kind of out in the country, but to be honest, I am that person who lies awake at night and listens and hears every single sound. And during the day, I'm also very careful. I don't just rush and open the door for anybody because I spend a lot of time reading about crime and murders and, well, I need to have my bases covered and feel secure. So I've got both the Ring video doorbell and their new great product called the Ring Floodlight Cam. Just like Ring's amazing doorbell, the Floodlight Cam is motion-activated camera and floodlight and has HD video and two-way audio, and that lets you know the moment anyone steps on your property. Right now, as a listener, you can save up to $150 off of a Ring of Security kit when you go to ring.com/undisclosed. While it's true that you can't put a price on your family or your home safety, it does help when you can save $150. So as a listener, once again, go to ring.com/undisclosed and get $150 off your Ring of Security kit today. To rebut the prosecution's case, the defense presented an alibi defense. Before getting to that defense, let's reorient ourselves to the crime timeline. Juddie Boss said she looked at the clock in her bedroom when packing and saw that it was 9:30 p.m. She then made some food in the kitchen for about 10 minutes, which takes us to 9:40 p.m. Boss then went to the den where she was assaulted for about another 10 minutes, meaning the assault went from about 9:40 to 9:50 p.m. After the assault, Boss ran to her neighbor's house, leading to a 911 call and Sergeant Jack Purnell arriving about a half minute later at 9:57 p.m. It's not exact timing, but it seems pretty safe to assume from the time of Sergeant Purnell's arrival that the assault occurred between about 9:40 and 9:50 p.m., possibly a few minutes earlier. Let's now turn to Ronnie Long's timeline. Ronnie's friend, Walter Lee Steele, testified that Ronnie and their friend, Mae Mitchell, arrived at the house at 3 p.m. in Mae's car and drove around for the next couple of hours. After this, Ronnie went home to see whether he could use the family car. But Ronnie's father, Ike, had used the car to drop off his wife, Elizabeth, at the Beulah Baptist Church and was still using the car at that point. Ronnie's mother still remembers these events today.
My husband had tipped the car, and he was sitting up on the corner talking with Burt Smith. He never did come, so Ronnie had some friends come and pick him up. And they went over there on Alma Drive to a class meeting.
So, after riding around with Mitchell and Steele from about 3 to 5 p.m., Ronnie headed home to see if he could use a family car. His mom estimated this was about 5:30 p.m., and Ronnie's mom told him that his father still had the car, so some friend took him to a class meeting at Paulette Steele's house, which was down the block and which witnesses say started between 5 and 5:30 p.m. One of those witnesses was Ronnie's friend, Terrence Stocks.
We had a class meeting that day. That was a Sunday. Yeah, we had a class meeting that day. I can't remember. That wasn't at Paulette's house. I'm thinking that was either Paulette or Gracie's ball night's house. One of the houses, right?
Right.
According to Stocks, there were about 30 people at this meeting, and a handful of them testified to seeing Ronnie at the meeting, including Paulette Steele and Kenneth Byers. It's important to note that everyone at the meeting was African American. Here's Ronnie Long's high school classmate and friend, Kristen Reich, who is now an attorney.
Were you there for either the reunion party or the party that night?
No, I was not. and this is also, it's only black people who are invited to it. So that's why I say it was not really truly a school reunion thing. It was more just people from the Logan community. And one of the things to understand about Concord, are you familiar with it at all? The town?
Somewhat. I haven't ever been there, but I've been sort of in and around Charlotte, so I guess it's not too far away. But yeah, I mean, if you could give some insight into, I guess, what was it like back in 1976 to start?
Well, when I was growing up, I was born in 1955, and in 1976, it was still, even though we had integration, and schools were, of course, fully integrated, the communities themselves and where people lived was still totally segregated. We had several different areas of Concord. One was called Shankletown, and that was on the west side of town, and it was largely populated, in fact, probably entirely populated with a black population. On the east side of town, you had Logan community, and it was also called Black Bottom. And at that time, that wasn't derogatory. It was just Black Bottom was what you called it, or Logan. The Logan community is where Ronnie lived, and where all of these other individuals who are, who testify for Ronnie, that's where they lived. Now, Ken Byers had already moved, and Terrence had already moved to Charlotte, I believe, at that time, if I remember, because I was in Concord off and on. I was still living in Concord, basically, at that time in 1976, but the communities were still segregated, and when people had parties, it was largely black party or a white party. You didn't have a lot of mingling, except, as I was saying, and that was the important part of Concord, is if you played any kind of athletics, you were more integrated in your community of friends.
The racial dynamics in Concord found their way into the courtroom, as they did in the Walter McMillan case in Monroeville. As we've noted, the courtroom was divided on racial lines, and all of the witnesses who testified for the state were white, while all of the witnesses who testified for Ronnie Long were black. Of course, we can only guess what effect these racial dynamics had on the all-white jury. What we do know is this, that the witnesses at the class meeting described Ronnie Long as wearing different clothes than what Judy Boss said her assailant had on that day. As you might recall, Boss said her assailant was wearing dark jeans. But Terrence Stock testified that he remembered Ronnie wearing tan pants and said he remembered this fact because someone made a crack about all of the boys in Long's family wearing khakis. When Colin spoke to Terrence, he still recalled the pants.
And looking at your testimony, it seemed that you remember that Ronnie was wearing tan pants that day?
Yeah. As far as I can remember. I'm not sure if that was the same day we took pictures, but we took some pictures during the time back then, and that those were shown to us by a news reporter from Channel 36 by the name of, I think, Stuart somebody.
Terrence is referring to Stuart Watson of Channel 36 in Charlotte, who did a story on Ronnie Long, and we're still trying to track down those photos. What's easier to determine, though, is the person who made the crack about the tan pants. It was their mutual friend, Kenneth Byers, who testified that he tapped his cousin's shoulder at the class meeting and told him that Ronnie Long must have gotten the pants three for a dollar because everyone in the family had a pair, which led to everyone around them laughing. Byers also testified that Ronnie was wearing a light-colored shirt and that he couldn't ever remember seeing Ronnie wearing jeans. In addition, Byers added some important context about the likelihood that an assailant other than Ronnie Long could have been wearing a leather jacket like the one described by Juddy Bost. According to Byers, most African-American men their age wore a jacket like that. Quote, "'Cause a movie came out, like when Shaft first came out. And all the black dudes, you know, everybody was, it was a fad. Everybody was wearing, you know, black leather jackets. And they just never quit, you know, since then. It's been a thing among black people." Finally, as we noted last episode, several witnesses from the class meeting testified that Ronnie Long was wearing the chauffeur's hat that he typically wore and that they'd never seen him with the toboggan, like the police say they recovered from the Long family car. Now, getting back to the timeline, several witnesses testified that the class meeting started between 5 and 5:30 p.m. and ran until 6 or 6:30 p.m., at which point Ronnie and some other classmates made a beer run to a place called Her Lockers, and then returned to Paulette Steele's place. All of the witnesses then agree that everyone hung out at Paulette Steele's house until 8 p.m. Ronnie's classmate, Walter Steele, testified that he left with Ronnie, another classmate named Manuel, and drove around for about half an hour, with Ronnie being dropped at home at about 8:30 p.m. Ronnie's mother, Elizabeth, still has a good recollection of what happened next.
"And they brought him back here, and he got out, and he was here, looking at some store we were. And it's been so long, he was looking at some store, and I was washing dishes. They called me down there to see it, and the son called. His girlfriend called, because she was sick, and he was talking to his son. He's 2 years old. He was talking to him. That's where he was, upstairs, talking to him. And that Sunday, that same Sunday, he didn't leave to about, he left him about, when my husband came back, it was about, I think it was 9:30 or 10:30. And he left here, got in the car, and he went to some kind of something they was having in Charlotte.
If you're hiring, you know that every business needs great people, but you also know that every business needs a better way to find them because, you know what? Just posting your job online is like shouting into the void and hoping that someone hears it and praying that they actually respond and it's the right person. Well, ZipRecruiter knew that there was a smarter way, so they built a platform that finds the right job candidates for you. ZipRecruiter learns what you're looking for, they identify people with the right experience, and they invite them to apply to your job. These invitations have revolutionized how you find your next hire. In fact, 80% of employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate through their site in just a single day. And ZipRecruiter doesn't just stop there. They even spotlight the strongest applications you get so you never miss a great match. The right candidates are out there, and ZipRecruiter is how you find them. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, completely free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. That's ZipRecruiter.com/undisclosed. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
So breaking that all down, Ronnie arrives home at 8:30 p.m., reads some stories for about half an hour, and then talks on the phone with his son, the mother of his son, and Elizabeth, his mother, with Ronnie on the phone upstairs and Elizabeth on the phone in the kitchen. Ronnie then leaves when his father arrives home with a family car at about 9:30 or 10:30 p.m. And if you're wondering why Ronnie's mother is confused about Ronnie's departure time, the answer is maybe the most frustrating thing about this case. Daylight savings was at 2 a.m. on April 25th, 1976, and the prosecutor got Ronnie's mother to admit that they might not have turned their clocks forward, meaning they might have been off an hour on the time. And this is significant because the Long residence was 1.1 miles away from the Boss residence. So if Ronnie Long left at 9:30 p.m., that would have given him just enough time to get Boss's house and scale the banister in time for the assault that Boss said started at 9:40 p.m. In addition to getting Ronnie's mother to question the time of the call, the prosecutor also got the mother of Ronnie's son to wonder if she was off by an hour. But although the issue wasn't raised at trial, we've determined that they weren't off on the time, at least according to Janice Marie Spears, the mother of Ronnie's child. At trial, Spears vividly remembered the night of April 25th. She had been sick and fighting with Ronnie about a concert she had attended without him at the Charlotte Coliseum. That night, when Ronnie called, she had just finished watching a TV show.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive. Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
So Janice Spears testifies that Ronnie Long called soon after the end of the $6 Million Man, and we were able to find the old TV listings from that night. They showed that a rerun of the $6 Million Man episode, Divided Loyalty, ran from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock p.m. So when Spears testified that Ronnie called at 9 o'clock p.m. right after this show ended, she would have been right. And Spears said the call lasted about 45 minutes, until 9:45 or 9:50 p.m. Now again, Judy Boss testified that she was assaulted from 9:40 to 9:50 p.m. with the first officer arriving at the scene at 9:57 p.m. So if Spears and Ronnie's mother are right, Ronnie was upstairs on the phone at the exact same time as the assault. Now, according to Ronnie's mother, after the phone call, she could hear Ronnie listening to music in his bedroom, and she remembers the grandfather clock chiming at 10 o'clock p.m. She then estimated that about 25 to 30 minutes passed before Ronnie's father arrived home with a Long family car between 10:25 and 10:30 p.m., which is the same time that Ronnie's father testified that he arrived home.
This syncs up with the testimony of another classmate, Ruthine Howie Stokes, who was also at the class meeting earlier that day. Terrence Stocks and Kenneth Myers had a place in Charlotte, and several classmates had agreed to meet up at their place for a party later that night. Stokes was a student at Barber Scotia College, which is 0.9 miles from the Long residence. According to Stokes, Ronnie Long drove up to the college between 10:25 and 10:30 p.m. and asked if she wanted to go to the party. If you're wondering how Stokes remembered the time so well, the reason she gave at trial was similar to the reason that Asia McLean gave in the Adnan Syed appeal. Here's the exchange at trial.
Question, why do you recall the time?
Because he, later that day, about when I got out of the class meeting, I was let out at Scotia, and I told him I was waiting on my boyfriend and that we would ride to the party with him, so I remember the time because I was mad with my boyfriend. I had been waiting about 2 hours for him to come down, and I had gotten upset, so that's why I knew what time it was, because I looked at the clock, and the lady at the dorm was getting ready to lock up the lounge.
Because Ronnie was in a car, Ruthine couldn't see the lower part of his body, but she was able to say that he was wearing the same chauffeur's hat that he was wearing at the class meeting earlier that day. She also said that he was wearing a light-colored shirt with some kind of prints in it over the top of his jacket, and that he was acting completely normal. You might recall that Boss testified that everything her assailant was wearing was dark. So, timing-wise, if we're to believe the state's case, we have to believe that 1. Elizabeth Long and Janice Spears were lying or mistaken about the timing of the call with Ronnie. 2. Ronnie changed his clothes to clothes such as a toboggan and jeans that no one had ever seen him wearing that day. 3. He committed the assault between 9:40 and 9:50 p.m., and then he arrived home for a quick change back into his class meeting clothes. And finally, he got over to Barber Scotia College by 10:25 to 10:30 p.m. and was acting completely normal. And it seems like Stokes' time estimate was pretty good because she testified that her boyfriend arrived at 10:40 p.m., a few minutes after Ronnie left. And if she was waiting for 2 hours for him to arrive, it's a pretty safe bet that she made a note of the time. Colin was able to talk to Stokes, and she has a memory of seeing Ronnie that night as he was heading to the party in Charlotte. Her recollection now, though, is that he came to her house, which was only a few blocks from Barber Scotia College.
And we were going to go to a party, and we were celebrating. I can't remember that part. You have to understand, I've been deep in Concord.
Yeah, I understand. It's
but I do remember Ronnie came to my house that night. I do remember the college because I lived so close to the college, so everybody that was... And Ronnie... came and
he rung the doorbell, and he was standing on the front porch, and I said, okay, I'll be right out. And I went back in. I had a daughter at that time. And I came back out, and we walked to the car. And said, I can't see in that little short length of time how they said he ran through the alley. He walked, got up on the woman's roof right there and came back and was standing on my front porch. He would have had to do that in 2 minutes. Because I wasn't in the house that long.
So we should note that there's some discrepancy between the Stokes trial testimony and what she told Colin. But again, we should note that her place was close to the college, and Colin was asking her to recall something from 42 years ago. Continuing along with the timeline for the day, another defense witness was Doris Nesbitt, who lived in Charlotte. She testified that Ronnie arrived at her house at about 11 or 11:05 p.m., which would sync with Stokes' testimony. According to Google Maps, a drive from Barbara Scotia College and Nesbitt's place would take between 26 to maybe 35 minutes on a Sunday night, which fits with Ronnie seeing Stokes until about 10:35 p.m. Nesbitt testified that they stayed at her place until about 11:30 before heading over to the party, arriving at about 11:45 p.m. As we noted before, the party was the place being rented by Terrence Stocks and Kenneth Byers. Byers testified that Ronnie and Nesbitt arrived at the party between 11 and 12 that evening. He said that when Ronnie arrived, he approached him, shook his hand, and asked if he wanted a beer. Byers testified that Ronnie had no scratches, bruising, bleeding, and that he was wearing the same clothes as earlier in the day, tan pants and a light-colored shirt. Terrence Stocks, meanwhile, remembered Ronnie Long arriving at the party with Doris Nesbitt sometime after 11. Stocks testified that there was nothing unusual about Ronnie's face and that he didn't see any cuts or scratches or bruises. And here's what he told Colin when he talked to him recently.
Do you remember Ronnie coming to that party?
Yes, I did. He and this girl by the name of Doris Nesbitt. Doris, they came into their apartment. It was after 10 or so because the news was something was on during that time. So it was later that Sunday night.
And do you remember when Ronnie arrived at the party, whether there seemed to be anything out of the ordinary with him?
No. But just like I said, we invited people over. Most of the time it's a couple thing, and a few guys were there, but he came in with a young lady.
Finally, Doris Nesbitt testified that at about 2:30 a.m., Ronnie and she left the party and went back to her house and had sexual relations. She made no mention of Ronnie having any cuts or bruises or anything like that. Ronnie Long didn't testify at the trial, but he relayed the same timeline of events to Colin over the phone. The audio quality isn't great, but his version of the story was clear. Class meeting, arriving home, talking with Janice Spears and his son on the phone, his father coming home with a car, driving over to Barbara Scotia, picking up Doris Nesbitt, heading to the party, and then going home with Nesbitt. In terms of alibis, this is a pretty strong one, but the jury didn't buy it. They found Ronnie Long guilty of rape and burglary, which led to a mandatory life sentence for both. Once the verdict was announced, chaos ensued. Here's Kayla Ayers reporting for Fox 46 in Charlotte.
Violence broke out in Concord when an all-white jury convicted Long largely on the victim's eyewitness ID.
And here's reporting from Stuart Watson.
The case divided Concord along racial lines. After the verdict, white police beat black protesters with billy clubs and maced them in the courthouse. Protesters threw rocks and set fires.
Ronnie's mother still has a recollection of the violence after the verdict and her daughter being pepper sprayed.
But they sprayed her and she couldn't see. And I was down on the elevator. They wasn't letting us go down on the elevator like we should have, but kept a whole lot of us up there in the hall. I think my daughter went down the steps. And it was terrible.
Back in 1976, the people on Ronnie Long's side of the courtroom knew that he was innocent and their son, their brother, their friend was being sent to prison for a crime he didn't commit. But there's something else they didn't and couldn't know back then. There was physical evidence taken from the crime scene and tested. A lot of it. And none of it pointed in Ronnie Long's direction. Schrodinger's cat, next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks so much to all of you for tuning in this week, and we have a whole host of other people to thank for making this season possible, as they do every season. First of all, thank you to our sponsors for helping bring us back week after week. Thank you, Baluki, for designing our logo. Thank you, Chrissy, for maintaining our website. Thanks so much, Mithil Thelhan, our amazing executive director. A big thanks to Mr. Henry Lavoie for helping with research for this series. And if that name sounds familiar, it should be, because he is the son of our awesome audio producer, Rebecca Lavoie, who is not just our audio producer, but also the host and producer of the fantastic podcast, Crime Writers On, which I don't miss any week. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Our Twitter handle and Facebook is at Undisclosed Pod. And if you have questions for the addendum, don't forget to get Mr. John Cryer's attention and our producer attention by tagging them with hashtag UD Addendum. Thanks so much. Until next week.